Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. This is Carl Shenneman from Jurnov, and I'm really pleased that we're doing another show here on specific areas, substantive areas of law. We're going to focus on e-discovery in the patent law area. And, of course, ESI Bytes is a show that's available at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when people find the topic interesting, because that's when you can download it. I'm very happy with our panel today. We've got a very diverse panel. First, we've got Mark Michaels from Cisco out in California. Mark joined Cisco in January 1996 as their first attorney dedicated to support the U.S. federal sales team. Mark's responsibilities soon expanded to include managing the legal team supporting Cisco sales organizations in the Western Hemisphere. In late 2000, Mark moved from supporting sales to becoming the first attorney at Cisco responsible for managing commercial litigation and disputes. And in his current role, he focuses on litigation, case management, and discovery support. Mark also speaks all over the place. I've seen him speak at the Georgetown Conference before, and thrilled you're on our panel, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and our other panelist is outside counsel, Ed Rippey, as a partner at Covington & Burling in Washington, D.C. He manages complex commercial cases in numerous fields with a focus on patent litigation. He's managed matters throughout the country for several Fortune 500 companies, and these matters have included patent, antitrust, consumer, transportation, energy, sports, environmental, copyright, communications, and security laws. He co-chairs Covington & Burling's e-discovery practice group, and he regularly speaks nationwide on this topic. He's involved in all sorts of e-discovery organizations, from being on the advisory board at IQPC, LexisNexis Litigation Solutions Advisory Board, Applied Discoveries Advisory Board, DRIs, e-discovery committee, CPRs, e-discovery committee, and he's given lots of speeches and presentations nationwide on e-discovery, just like Mark has, and on related topics such as patent litigation, risk management, cost containment, privacy, Web 2.0 issues, instant messaging, document retention and destruction. Ed, given your eclectic background, I think you're going to be on a couple of podcasts going forward. I can think of a few looking at this background. But I'm thrilled you're on this podcast as well. And let's start off just generally. I always like to ask, first of all, Mark, I'll ask you, then Ed, how did you begin working in electronic discovery?
Well, thanks, Carl. For me, it was a little bit of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. It really wasn't a choice for me. I was the litigation manager at the time. And for Cisco, when I took over that role in early 2000, we had not had a long history of litigation, but things were about to change for us in 2000. I did have substantial experience in private practice managing large discovery matters, and I was well aware of the expense and disruption that could result from poorly managed discovery, but I had no idea what the expenses would become or could become in dealing with electronic information. So as a matter of survival, I had to jump in there. I would tell you that my company was relatively young, and the vast majority of my company's data are electronic form. So I often tell people that we didn't really call it e-discovery until the federal rules changes popularized the term. I would tell people that back in the day we called it discovery.
And Ed, how about yourself?
Yeah, I think I began in this field about 10 years ago in 1999 when I was an associate here at Covington. The firm was handling the ExxonMobil merger, which at that time was the biggest merger that had ever come about. And you can imagine that with those two companies, there was just an enormous amount of data, particularly electronic data, that we had to sift through and produce to the Federal Trade Commission. There was also an enormous amount of hard copy documents that we needed to consider. At that time, I don't think anything was called e-discovery. It was a totally different sort of world. But I think that's where it started. I became very familiar with, at least at that time, what was cutting-edge technological issues, and I think that that just carried through as I moved up the ranks at the firm.
Great. Let's sort of introduce the topic of intellectual property litigation. Ed, why is electronic discovery relevant to intellectual property litigation?
Well, I think you see in the case law that it is very relevant to IP litigation. That probably stems from a variety of factors. For instance, you know, many of the types of IP cases that we handle here at the firm, they involve large amounts of documents and data. For instance, a patented product could have a long product history. It could also be the subject of substantial marketing efforts over, you know, years, if not decades. So that in many situations, we see cases that have, you know, huge amounts of documents, you know, millions of pages or millions of documents. And for that reason alone, there's a substantial and important e-discovery component. You know, another factor that I think contributes in here is that often IP cases have an antitrust component, and those typically involve a lot of documents and knotty e-discovery issues. Probably a third reason that I can think of is that, you know, there are some jurisdictions that have special rules for patent cases, you know, like in Texas or New Jersey or the Northern District of California, and that you have to be attentive to these special rules that govern electronic discovery in patent cases. So I think that, you know, those are some of the factors. I'm sure there are others, but those are the ones that seem most salient to me.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about patent prosecution and IP rights and e-discovery. And Mark, how do policies regarding electronically stored information support the successful prosecution of a patent or other IP issues?
Well, frankly, I would tell you that I don't see the electronically stored information or ESI policies really affecting patent prosecution or IP generally. And the reason I say that, I should first acknowledge that the focus on ESI has served to highlight the longstanding need to ensure that records related to IP ownership and development are maintained in accordance with good records retention policies. But that's not new. I would say that was the legal advice long before there was something called ESI. And savvy entities made sure that they could document invention conception and were mindful of the need to control intellectual property disclosures. I guess I would say that really what's changed, and Ed alluded to this, is just, you know, the proliferation of data and getting your arms around it. But again, if we hadn't had any changes to the federal rules, if nobody had come up with the word ESI, you know, I would see the same, you know, same fundamental issues of good record retention apply in these situations.
Okay, and what data security issues arise in the regular course of business that pertains to this area?
Well, I think most companies, clients of ours, have, you know, data security issues, but they are particularly important in the IP litigation realm. It's a big concern. And I think that in the IP realm, the most sort of obvious point here is that there is a need for, you know, secure and safe electronic systems and policies that guard against the misappropriation of company data. You know, so if the company has information or secrets that it wants to keep, you know, to itself, they need to have systems in place that give them that type of assurance. You know, there's also issues relating to protecting source code for some of our clients, and that can be an issue. So I think, as a general matter, all clients are concerned about data security issues, but in particular, IP clients have this sort of added layer of concern that they are attentive to.
And I might mention, I know of some companies out here in Silicon Valley that are so concerned about protecting their own intellectual property that they won't even let their outside counsel do sort of first pass document review on some of their more sensitive technology. Now, I haven't heard that very often, but I was surprised to hear at least one company out here tell us that that's their practice.
Yeah, that I have not run into that, but that does not at all surprise me. You know, similar to the comment that you're bringing up now, sometimes with IP clients, when you're going to use an outside vendor to, you know, process documents, the very primary concern, the primary issue, has to do with the security of the third-party vendor's systems. So they want to make sure that whatever is being processed by the vendor isn't sort of fair game for people to see, you know, and they want to be able to limit people seeing the information. So I think that's it doesn't surprise me. I think that's a common concern out there.
You know, that sort of goes into a direction I've been doing a couple podcasts on with managing these cases with good, better project management. And I've been an advocate of sort of cloud systems because you've got so many different vendors and law firm and reviewers and getting them all on the same page. Sort of the cloud has a lot of potential for actually enabling people to work together. But you've raised some pretty interesting issues there about the security of the data that, I'm not suggesting it would be like a Twitter system because Twitter's been in the news for being hacked into for using the Google system.
Right.
But you know, that's an added wrinkle, I think, to better project management, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would certainly agree with that. And, you know, while, you know, I'm the last to say we shouldn't be, you know, using all sorts of networking to get our jobs done, you know, it also is one issue that people think about when they're trying to make a business case for managing their e-discovery. It's one of the factors, in some cases, a key factor if you've got a heavy dose of IP litigation, to make investments for in-house discovery teams and investments in in-house tools so that you really minimize, you know, at the first instance, what goes out your door.
It's also interesting that you all brought up the cloud and cloud computing, because this is a very, very timely issue for us. I'd say over the last, you know, month or two, we've received half a dozen requests for advisory work on cloud-related issues.
Hmm.
So, and like I say, not even 6 months ago, I'm talking about this very timely, within the last month or 6 weeks, and I am wondering just to myself, you know, how, if this is going to be sort of a permanent line of inquiry that we start to receive over the next year or two, and it very well may be.
You know, I ran a virtual law firm in a sort of a sabbatical role for a couple of years when I stepped out of eDiscovery, and I used the cloud, and the clients loved it. It was very easy, but it is easy and it's hackable, so there are other issues out there. but I thought it would work for eDiscovery based on my experiences in some cases. Let's talk about the characteristics of eDiscovery and patent litigation, and you know, what are some of the major characteristics, Mark, of a patent case, and how do they affect eDiscovery issues?
Well, I will tell you from my perspective, and I think Ed hit the nail on the head in his opening comments, is the patent cases can touch a wide range of data. They certainly touch engineering and marketing and sales. And when you add in manufacturing, pretty soon there isn't a part of the company that may not, that you could avoid looking for documents. And add to that the excitement of finding yourself in a rocket docket with limited time available to collect data. That often causes some challenges. So depending on the size of your company and the product line, there may be situations where almost every person in the company may have potentially responsive data. I would also note that at a high level, the documentation can be highly technical and voluminous. And, you know, there's all sorts of tools out there that will help you, you know, attack large sets of data. But you have to master the vocabulary in order to even, you know, start a search to identify relevant data. And just in case that isn't enough, you know, from a business perspective, the expense of patent litigation and the associated discovery expense, and you combine that with a potentially significant business impact, I think you really see the need for good early case assessment tools in these kinds of cases. The business wants to know immediately what the strengths and risks are, And in some respects, data in electronic form facilitates an earlier case assessment because the data can be loaded into analytical tools. In the old days, you know, it was a matter of working through tons of documents, coding them, and then, you know, months later figuring out what you had. So I would say those are a few that come to mind.
And Ed, looking at sort of trends that you see in patent cases, what are some of the top e-discovery trends that seem to be there?
Yeah, I think maybe I'll highlight one that does not appear in the case law and one that does appear in the case law. Outside the case law, I found in my own practice that the courts in IP cases are putting increasing emphasis on the meet and confer process. In one patent litigation that I'm handling now, the court ordered the most senior attorneys on each side to appear for a meet and confer in the chambers, even though the court wouldn't be attending. In other words, it was a message to the attorneys on both sides that the meet and confer process is important, and the court wants the senior attorneys to meet and confer in good faith, and if you're not going to do it on the phone, then I want you to do it here in chambers, and I'll be available to resolve a dispute. So, you know, I mentioned that as an example where, you know, the meet and confer process is hugely important now in these kind of cases, and the courts want the attorneys to engage in them early and often and as often as necessary. In another patent litigation, we were on a teleconference to resolve a discovery dispute. Opposing counsel brought up that there was another discovery motion pending, and the court said, you know what, I'm just going to strike this second motion for the record. I don't want to deal with it. I don't have time to deal with it, and you all need to go work it out on your own. Go engage in more meet and confers until you've resolved it. So I'm highlighting these as ones that is a trend that doesn't necessarily show up in the case law, but that to me in day-to-day practice is just very important. In the case law, I think one trend that is worth noting is the continued and increased emphasis on preserving documents and defending, being able to defend your document collection. There was a case, Forest Labs, out of the Eastern District of Michigan this spring, I think it was in April of 2009, in which the court emphasizes the need to pay attention to how you go about preserving backup tapes in certain scenarios. The court held that, you know, there may not ordinarily be a duty to preserve inaccessible backup tapes, but then it went on to set some sort of test that would make a party obligated to preserve backup tapes. And the reason I'm highlighting this is that frequently in practice, parties will stipulate that backup tapes don't need to be searched and documents don't need to be produced from them. Sometimes there's not a stipulation covering that, and parties seem to operate under the assumption that as long as they're quote-unquote inaccessible, they won't be at issue. But I think that Force Labs is an IP case, and there are other cases outside the IP realm that are taking what I would call a new look at backup tapes and what your obligations are in regard to documents on the backup tapes.
So the mantra is still preserved broadly.
Yeah, I think absolutely. At the start of the case, you can't be too conservative. Look, if you enter a stipulation later and backup tapes along with 17 other sources are declared mutually to be off limits, then that's fine. But, you know, once the hold goes out and you're involved in litigation, I think it's prudent to, you know, preserve all these types of documents until you've decided not to do so with the other side.
Mark, I thought of one follow-up question on one of the points you raised about the need to master vocabulary to start a search. You know, the fascinating thing about e-discovery is all the new tools that keep being developed. And there have been, you know, a fair amount of activity in the concept search engine area. I've done a couple of podcasts in that area as well,
mm-hmm.
and having to work a little bit in that area. And, you know, the one hand, you've got linguistic models where you load in terms to find as much as possible. But there are, you know, semantic search engines that are out there that can help you pull clusters of documents. Do you see something like that being useful to upfront start grabbing documents, particularly for IP, because of that complexity?
Well, I could see a situation where it might be helpful. One of the things that we've noticed is that if your target population for your patent cases tends to be engineering documents, well, the data, the document population and the terminology is relatively homogenous. So if you think that you're going to be able to call a substantial amount of information and just set it aside, I don't see it being that productive in a sense, because you've already self-selected. But on the other hand, a clustering type of tool or something that shows you a relative number of hits could show you some peculiar terms that you might not see. But having said that, you might not pay much attention to them if you don't understand what they are in context. For example, a lot of development programs have cute little code words, could be fairly innocuous, and if you didn't know that those code words could potentially mean something, and in that population there are other similar terms that are used commonly, I suspect that you might get misled a little bit. And I think the real key here is unfortunately from our perspective, we have to start in early on interviewing engineers and our subject matter experts to get our arms not only around the technology but the terminology as well. So I could see these tools assisting in helping you identify at the outset some core terms, but really I think it's just rolling up your sleeves and trying to learn like we always have to in a case and what's important.
Okay, well let's talk a little bit about sanctions and patent litigation. And Ed, recently several courts have sanctioned litigants in patent cases for e-discovery misconduct. Do you want to discuss some of those decisions, and are these sanctions a new trend?
Sure. I don't know that the sanctions are necessarily a new trend. I think courts have always had at their disposal sanctions to get parties and attorneys to comply with certain obligations that they have. But the trend, it does seem to be new in the context of complicated, document-intensive e-discovery patent cases. Some of these cases that have come up are highly complex. The technology is highly complex. There are millions and millions and millions of pages of documents at issue. There are scores of attorneys involved. This is major litigation, and I think that's sort of what may be perceived to be a new trend, but maybe it's the same type of thing going on. In other words, sanctions, but it's just a sort of bigger arena that they're taking place in. Everybody, I think, is aware of the Qualcomm decision, and that was from a year or two ago, and in the Southern District of California. I think that case served as a wake-up call to some people about different responsibilities that parties and attorneys had in regard to document preservation. I'm not going to dwell on that because that's been on the subject of much commentary out there. But recently, there's a case, Micron Technology, that was out of Delaware in January of this year. And this is a decision issued by Judge Sue Robinson, in which she sanctioned Rambus. And the way she did that was to invalidate certain patents because of inadequate document preservation. The party here that was involved engaged in a shredding day. And some of you may know that's where a day, maybe one day per year, where a company will engage in a document destruction that's in keeping with their document retention policy and in keeping with their litigation obligations. But what happened in this case was that the court sanctioned the firm for engaging in that in a way that was determined not to make sense or not to fulfill their obligations to retain documents. So, Micron Tech, in my mind, is sort of a follow-on to Qualcomm. There are many others. Some are within IP within the IP world, and some aren't. But like I say, I don't know that there's a trend other than the stakes are very high, the technology is very complicated, and a lot of people can be impacted. So again, you know, parties and attorneys need to be prudent in their document preservation efforts, particularly when you're dealing with complicated e-discovery systems.
Yeah, I'll just add, we did a nice podcast with Michael Lackey on Qualcomm. That's on ESI Bytes. And Mark, sanctions is obviously a very serious subject. From the in-house perspective, do you have any reaction or advice on how best to avoid sanctions?
Well, I'll tell you the case that Ed mentioned, the Micron case. It has some counterparts out here in the Northern District of California. And interestingly, on the same set of facts, the court here reached a somewhat different result and did not impose such draconian sanctions. And I really do think that it's a real indication of the court's discretion here and very factually intensive. But having said that, in many ways, I don't see this as anything new. And in these sanction cases, if you dig down deep into them, more often than not, and Ed can check me if I'm wrong, it's the kinds of things that would be sanctionable if we were in a paper situation as well, which is, you know, not knowing where your records are, not being forthcoming when you've made mistakes and things like that. It seems to me that even in the paper days, you ran significant risks if you didn't have a good discovery plan and good cooperation between in-house and outside counsel. And, you know, I learned early on in my first job that bad news doesn't get better with age. And so the sooner you do find an issue and resolve it, the better. I think the standard is one of reasonableness. And as long as we're behaving reasonably and we're forthcoming, then I think we manage sanctions well. It's when you try and be cute where things come off the rails, and that's what we try to manage carefully with our outside counsel.
Could I just amplify two points Mark made that I thought were excellent points? The first is I completely agree that, you know, maybe one way to view this is that you had these obligations in regard to paper records, hard copy, and for that reason it's not altogether new. I think that's a good way of looking at it. The other point that he raised, which I think is a very good one, has to do with the Rambis case that I was talking about. I, too, have read those decisions. You know, as Mark mentioned, one decision went one way against the company and ruled that it had done something wrong in regard to preservation. The other case ruled the other way, and the facts weren't just similar. They were practically identical. And there might have been a timing issue, maybe one included a different year, but I mean, they really were the same set of facts. And as Mark mentioned, it goes to show just how much discretion a court has. So if you're going to be careful, you definitely want to be conservative in your preservation efforts. And like I say, as Mark mentioned, the courts can come out on different ends on the same set of facts. So it's going to be prudent for you to know at the outset of your case what type of leanings your court has.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, there's that case in Utah that came down on preservation, which involved, I think, Dell, which was had to preserve even well before the litigation was filed. Shows how complicated this area can be.
Right. Once you have reason to know the lawsuit's going to be filed, right? Something along those lines.
Yeah. Anyway, let's go into cost containment a little bit, which is sanctions aren't people's favorite topic, but cost containment oftentimes is. So, Ed, you got any tips? A lot of clients, I'm sure Mark would listen if you had some tips on this increased cost pressures, given the fact that e-discovery is the largest expense associated with litigation. What can you do?
Don't be involved in litigation.
Opt out.
In all seriousness, though, in the post-economic meltdown world, cost containment for us is the number one issue. That's what we hear about. on day one and day 10 and day 100 that's really driving a lot of the decision making, and you know, there are only finite amount of resources to go around to deal with e-discovery, which many people consider to just be a cost center. So we try to partner with people like Mark or other clients out there and develop a strategy up front at the start of the case that will help conserve costs. And we have all sorts of ways we do this. I'll highlight just a few. You know, as I mentioned before, one thing that you can do with opposing counsel is to enter an e-discovery stipulation, particularly where you have a litigation involving equally sized companies or similarly situated companies. That can go a long way to saving literally millions of dollars. The stipulation is a tool that I think everybody increasingly is coming to realize is important in the cost containment world. Also, on the vendor front, you know, one thing that one of the most powerful tools out there is generating hit reports or samples that give you a better feel for your universe of documents. So if you, for instance, have huge databases that you're searching and you are running search terms through it, you want to limit the flow as much as you can. So if your percentage of documents that are responsive is down in the 10% range as opposed to the 50% range, you're obviously going to save huge amounts of money. And Mark might be able to test this too. I think one rule of thumb out there in the industry is for every, dollar that you spend collecting a document and putting it in a database, searchable database, you're going to spend $7 or $8 in reviewing and producing it, because it takes attorney time to review documents and produce them and send them to the other side. So one theme that people should be particularly attentive to is limiting that flow of documents right up front so that you're not overwhelmed with these huge review costs later.
Okay. Those are some good, helpful tips. And always like hearing tips about using some of the tools to try to weed out what you got to review. Because that's what I focus on.
Well, Carl, I would say that, this has been the number one issue that I've dealt with now for years, because we have the luxury of hiring, great law firms, right? And so, we're confident we're going to work hard and get the best result. And so it really is a matter of much of what we do in-house is trying to manage the expense. And if you have a particularly heavy IP or patent document, then the prior planning really pays off. In patent cases, if you know where your technical documentation is stored, know how do you collect your data from your websites and have processes in place so that it's routine, the costs then become predictable. I would say also in patent litigation, and this is where counsel, particularly local counsel, if you're in a jurisdiction that's not familiar to you or you are outside counsel, is know the specifics of the venue. Northern California, Eastern District of Texas, Ed mentioned, they have patent rules. So that will let you know relatively early in the case, what products or technologies are accused. Similarly, the local discovery rules can help you out. At a minimum, you need to know them. Delaware, a popular patent litigation venue, has their default discovery rules that you certainly have to be mindful of in the court there. I know that Ed mentioned Rule 26F, and if there wasn't such a thing, I would insist that our outside counsel engage in a conversation with our opponents. One technique we've often looked at is focused on non-custodian data first. In our company and in many companies, the technical documentation are in repositories that are separate from the personal email. Now, if a startup's a different story, but a company that is established may have that, right? So, it may make sense to attempt to negotiate a production first with non-custodian data. And if you pulled it from a repository where lawyers don't play, then you can do pretty quick sort of first pass reviews, the equivalent of a first pass review, and you don't need a lot of eyes on on those documents. Couple that with the changes to Federal Rule 502, which I kind of understand, but maybe we'll ask Ed to chat a little bit about how that may play into this. And you can, you know, start to carve away some expenses. One of the niftiest thing I heard, I haven't had an opportunity to do this, but somebody told me on a case, and I believe it. One of the companies asserting a patent in the United States was a foreign company, and each side realized that in that case, email was in, you know, sort of relatively small value, and they just made a decision not to produce email at all. And you know, while I strive for that as our, you know, as our goal, at least when it comes to email, perhaps you could have a conversation with the other side that says, you know, you don't need email, you don't want email, and if they want to give you some willfulness terms like the patent number or inventor name, that's fine. But if they take a hard line, that's where we start the conversation about proportionality under Rule 26F, and start demonstrating the burden of that email, you know, and those costs certainly outweigh any potential benefit. And I would say the last thing that we might think about in this is we're seeing a trend in multi-defendant cases, and I trust, Ed, you're seeing the same thing. And there are opportunities for efficiencies where you can share e-discovery vendors and consultants if it makes sense in that context. So just a couple of ideas I might throw out there in terms of managing the cost.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with all that. And just to pick up on one thing you said, Mark, on a new Federal Rule of Evidence 502, generally speaking, I think companies have found some sort of reassurance with this rule. I mean, it used to be that some companies were highly concerned with the production of one privileged document because there was a risk that there would be a subject matter waiver just on the basis of that one inadvertent production. Whereas under Rule 502, if a company is taking reasonable steps not to produce privileged information, then you're not, the company can't be deemed to have waived privilege across the board. So what this has done is allowed companies to do a quicker and not a 100% review of the documents, shoot the documents out the door, and then as long as there were some steps looking for privilege, if they inadvertently produce a privilege document, they can claw that back and not waive the privilege. So on the cost containment front, I think many of our larger companies are finding some reassurance that, you know, they want to do the production in the way that according to the duties that they have. But if there's a way that they don't have to painstakingly go through every single document, this gives them some protection to do that. So it's not clear, though, in the case law, exactly what a court thinks are reasonable steps taken in a document production, but we're finding that out. But I think for the time being, this has been very favorably received to the corporations.
And I'll mention sort of a plug for future podcasts. I'm going to have Judge Paul Grimm on an upcoming show talking specifically about Rule 502, and I'll ask him those questions that you just mentioned there. Further clarification from Judge Grimm has never hurt. So, but anyway, well, this has been great. I appreciate you both joining us on the show. I'd also like to mention that I sort of threw out the Dell case, but we really didn't go into it much. I did a previous podcast with John Jablonski on legal holds, where we talked about that case and more specifically, you know, the challenges of legal holds. So with that in mind, thanks again for joining us on ESI Bytes. For the listeners that are interested in listening to other shows, our complete library of podcasts are available at www.esibytes with a Y. And we all say here, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before eDiscovery bites you back. So thanks again, and have a nice day.